Miss Rout. It is the largest town in the lakes, with a popular ski resort and restaurants and hotels. At more than 100,000 inhabitants, it felt like New York City. We found a cheap hostel and set up shop. My mom had emailed her plans to come finish the trip with me at Torres del Paine. I was very happy to hear this. As much as our relationship confounded me, I always wanted to celebrate with her. I couldn't put a finger on it, but I knew that my deepest wounds were the place of my deepest meanings, and she was ground zero. My salvation was somewhere inside her. She would fly into Punta Arenas, the biggest town in Chile's deep south. She would rent an Airbnb and a car, and we'd hike and explore and take photos and celebrate. I had another month to make it to Punta Arenas, but soon after Bariloche, I would be leaving pavement again for 700 miles of gravel. Lots of cycling blogs talked about this stretch. It featured the most spectacular scenery, but the government had never bothered to pave it because too few people traveled there. In Bariloche, it was Halloween, the night before Parker and Ronnie left. We had beers and a good dinner and recounted stories of donuts and downhill days. The next day, they boxed up their bicycles and headed to the airport. In between our goodbye hugs, I could already feel the aloneness approaching, the final stretch. Just me and the road and my bicycle in Patagonia. First thing, I went to a bike shop in town and bought fatter tires, twice as wide as any I had ridden on. They looked absurd and sluggish. They would slow me down for the next 100 miles of pavement, but I'd be thanking the Lord for them the minute I hit the gravel of the Carretera Austral. Instead of slipping and sinking in and ruining the tires, I'd be able to ride normally-ish. When I went to pay the bill, the woman behind the hostel counter hardly looked up from her computer. "Gracias," she said, already worrying about something else. I had coffee, I packed my bike, and I climbed on and began cycling. I was entering the final month of my journey, and no one was watching, which, though lonely, felt poetically personal and perfect. The road south from Bariloche took me into ever more dramatic terrain, the mountains higher, the snow whiter, the trees taller and thicker. Rivers of sparkling clarity tumbled over boulders. Sheep became common on the hillsides, with just the occasional horse for aesthetic appeal. I camped some, but mostly I stayed in small hostels. There I'd meet backpackers, day hikers, weirdos, and escape artists. Being alone gave me a sweet social freedom. I didn't have a travel partner, much less a clique. When you're sitting alone on the porch with a beer, a book, and a friendly face, almost anyone will talk to you. This has been a common experience for my whole life. Something about the way I hold my face, or my mediocre good looks, my unintimidating stature, my curious and friendly eyes, always leads strangers to talk to me. In any city, people ask me for directions. People ask me what book I'm reading. People talk to me, and I'm sure they don't know why. They might say, "You seemed nice," or, "You look like you're from here." But I bet they didn't have the thought first. They just felt familiar with me. It has been a constant reminder of the hidden motivations of all our actions, the signals we send, the language we all speak and cannot hear. 5 days out from Bariloche, I had wound my way around what must have been a dozen more lakes, mountains leaning right over the well-paved road, horses watching me roll by, and the occasional house or gas station. There were little towns with a few cafes and hostels in them. I was nearing the border with Chile, where the road would leave Argentina and dip into the famous Carretera Austral for a long while, from pavement to gravel for more than 700 miles. The last day to the border was spectacular. A meandering road took me through beautiful farmland and fields of lupins. These flowers were tall spears of purple, made up of hundreds of small purple flowers each, stacked on top of one another. The blue sky, the snow-topped mountains, the sky reflected in the cascading streams, and the purple flowers filling up the green fields, made for a world so idyllic that I sometimes felt overwhelmed, even defeated by it. I couldn't take it all in. The photos I took turned out dumb and dull. Nothing captured the colors or scale. While I biked, I listened to a podcast episode of Fresh Air with Terry Gross. She was interviewing Jill Soloway, the creator of the show Transparent, an Amazon series about a 70-year-old father coming out to his kids as transgender. The show documents his transition into life as a woman. I listened to this podcast enraptured by the evolution of gender, of pronouns, of culture. Terry Gross, a world-famous and seasoned interviewer, stumbled over the proper pronouns with Soloway, who lovingly corrected her several times. She, Gross would say, or do they prefer they? I remember Soloway explaining that some non-binary people, between genders, preferred the pronoun they, to which Terry Gross seemed to be surprised. "It isn't as difficult as people think," Soloway said. "When your roommate is headed to the airport to pick up a friend that you don't know, whose gender you don't know, it isn't strange to say, 'What time did they land?' See how easy that is?" Soloway went on to say that the show was inspired by her life, by her dad transitioning in his 70s, becoming her MAPA, a combination of mama and papa. As I cycled past the tall purple flowers and over bridges, my mind sorted through the ideas of gender fluidity and identity. I remember thinking that the sight of a cross-dressing man, a man in women's clothes, was funny to me, strange and silly. I remember thinking, "Does he really think we can't tell he's a man?" I would snicker and think, "What a weirdo." But then I realized, if I held hands with a boy 50 years ago, or even this year in certain places, wouldn't people snicker and point and whisper or worse? What is the difference? An awareness of my own hypocrisy stung me. I hadn't noticed this in myself, and from this thought, it spread in me an empathy for my mom, for the people in my church. If I, being in a category of oppression, could still mock another who is laterally the same as me, then how common must that hypocrisy be? And in being that way, they are not intentionally evil or bigoted, but groupish human beings wired to question difference. I thought of the power of storytelling, how exposure to this story of a trans woman was rewiring my brain, how Will and Grace had changed my young life, how encountering firsthand my sexuality had rewired the brains of some of my straight friends. Exposure to human stories reminds us that we're all human. I mean real exposure, listening, hearing, not pointing from across the room, engaging. And most of us are just trying to make it day by day without hurting anyone else. I still look at photos from that stretch of road and remember the sound of Terry Gross's voice, of Jill Soloway's calm surgery on my mind. 8 days after Bariloche, as I neared the border crossing, I spotted an Andean condor on the ground just off the road. A giant of a bird, the condor can stand 4 feet tall with a wingspan of 11 feet, perhaps the largest flying animal on Earth. This one was metallic black, with a white collar of feathers and a bald gray head. It just sat there in the field, not 20 feet away, looking back at me. Ferguson and Black Lives Matter and Transparent and transgendered people and the Bible and my mom and my sexuality and Terry Gross and Ebola. And this bird, unaware of it all, looking for some roadkill probably. It was not thinking about identity or gender or going extinct. It hungered for dinner and hungered for a mate. That's it. I wish, I thought. Then the condor opened its wings and with considerable effort lifted into the air and flew in widening circles over the Chilean border station, and we entered the new country together. Chapter 20. Alone in God's Most Obvious Work. The Carretera Austral. 1,222 miles to go. The road was paved for a few miles. Then, as I entered the Chilean town of Futaleufú, the surface turned to gravel. I had arrived at the start of the 700-mile stretch of gravel I had been told about. This was the Carretera Austral, a legendary road through Patagonia for motorcyclists and bikers that winds south through fjords and inlets too numerous to count. The coast is shredded into thousands of islands, with the Pacific Ocean weaving through. What is an ocean is lake, lakes everywhere, evergreen trees and sheep farms, and so many waterfalls that most are not named on any map I could find. I would cycle down this for the entire month of November. I would have Thanksgiving alone somewhere. Then, at the town of O'Higgins, where most people end their Carretera adventure, I would ferry across a glacier-fed lake back to Argentina one more time, then walk or carry my bike 12 miles through a dense forest, then another ferry, then I would be in El Chalten, the home of Mount Fitzroy. By now, I was so accustomed to my routine, to biking and living out of panniers, of eating salami and crackers and sleeping outside, that the approaching end of the trip felt obvious. I was just stepping into completion. It was all surprisingly transactional. I spent the night in Futaleufú and woke up to tackle the endless gravel. I set off, and the gravel was there to meet me. I rattled for the whole day. Several times, my backpack and sleeping bag shook off the back of the bike and fell on the road. I had to tie and retie my things. I was frustrated. My God, 700 miles of this. The rivers turned an even more absurd color of aquamarine, flowing from glaciers around me. Bits of snow hid in the shadowed places. Everything was beautiful, but the shaking really took a toll. Would I enjoy this? After 30 miles of vibrating down the road, I checked into a hostel in a little town. The hostel was actually the upstairs room in a family's house. I slept blessedly rattle-free, and in the morning the daughter made me coffee. The next day, I was prepared to rattle for 6 hours. I gave myself a pep talk over coffee and headed out. But right out of town, the gravel smoothed and became packed and hard. The riding was actually nice. Now I could enjoy the cliffs and the giant ferns and cascades, one after the other, spilling from mountaintops. The occasional truck roared past, kicking up a funnel cloud of dust. I put a bandana over my mouth to save my lips and throat. The next night, I slept by a river. In a thicket of trees near a pebble beach, the canopy had created a soft brown pad of moss and leaves. My tent fit perfectly. And the site was perfect for bathing. I saw no sign of humanity anywhere, not a sheep or a fence, just river, mountains, tall trees with gray bark and dark green evergreen leaves, waterfalls, and the river valley extending forever south. I got naked and took a dip in the turquoise river. It was freezing. So cold, I lost my breath and could only submerge for 2 seconds, maybe less. I got wet, clambered out to apply soap and scrub down a bit, then took another dip, then screamed. The whole time, I was talking myself through this out loud. Okay, now you dip again. Ugh! I know, Jed, you hate it, but it's necessary. Fuck! Your bike shorts are disgusting. Shit! And you can't have your grundle being a filthy crevice. Grr! You owe it to your bike seat. I crawled in my tent feeling fresh and clean. I snuggled up and put my winter jacket behind my head on top of my backpack for a pillow. I opened my laptop and checked what movies I had downloaded. It would be nice to have some wine and watch a movie. All alone out here. Outside, the river's white noise filled the air. I had downloaded season 1 of The Walking Dead. Zombies walked through the streets and yards, busting down the door of a suburban house and killing and eating the guts of humans. The music was scary, the lighting dark. This kind of thing wouldn't bother me in the least at home, but suddenly my hearing was superhuman. As I watched the show, I heard bugs walking outside, or was it a person? Am I being hunted? Will I die out here? I closed my laptop and chugged my wine, angry that I'd watched even part of the show. The following day, I camped in someone's yard. I rolled up to the little town and asked if there was a hotel. They said no, but pointed to a house. I knocked and asked about camping. The lady said sure and pointed to the grass next to the tool shed. I paid the family a little bit to let me use their bathroom. After I set up my tent, a group of backpackers appeared in the yard, apparently sent here by the same person. They were gregarious and confident, speaking Hebrew and laughing as they set up their tents. I deduced that they were from Israel. When I greeted them in English, they responded warmly. Soon, I had shared my box wine, and they gave me a cigarette. But I was tired and not much fun, and went to bed early while they cracked one another up all night. I wondered if the lady in the house regretted her generosity. 10 days down the carretera, the road had become lonely routine, cycling on gravel, staying at a little house or camping. Everywhere the wonders of Patagonia rose up around me, but by then, and with no one to exclaim to, I stopped exclaiming. I looked, and my eyes were happy, but I had no one to sing the praises of creation to, only the creation itself. Maybe God was there, proud of his work, but he isn't surprised by things, and he doesn't respond with laughter when I jump for joy. Not that I could tell, anyway. So I stopped jumping. I just tried to make the miles. I stopped taking photos of waterfalls. The days dripped by, and I spent a lot of time in silence. I didn't have to camp as much as I'd thought. Even the smallest towns had a room for rent. The carretera was used to hosting cyclists. I spent Thanksgiving at a simple hostel on a lake. Chile doesn't celebrate American Thanksgiving, of course, so it wasn't much of a celebration. I sat with my coffee in the morning and wrote in my journal. Thanksgiving, 2014. Lao General Carretera, Chile. I am alone, near no one I know. This is one of America's biggest holidays, at least in respect to family, and they are very far away from me. So, as an exercise in mindfulness, and because I believe gratitude is the door to joy, I'm going to list some of the things I'm thankful for. Parents I respect. A mother of strong and tender character, endless talent, humor, wisdom, playfulness, taste. A father of kindred heart, with a hunger for adventure, laughter, experience, love. They are both so full of love. My sister Rebecca, her heart and mind of fire, her caretaking powers, her love. My brother, his angelic spirit and perfectly matched wife, I love them so. My little sister, she is a soft-voiced, strong-hearted force. I love being near her. What a modern family made whole with grace and kindness. My health, my strong bicycle, this natural beauty, fjords, so many waterfalls, rivers, God's ridiculous paintings, and all those hearts I carry in my heart. Those boards and nails that build my house. And then I went on for 2 pages listing every friend that has touched my life. Pushing out words of thanks felt important in my fogginess. Fake it till you make it. It isn't that I wasn't thankful. It's that I felt so bound up in my unknowing that I couldn't figure out who to thank or who to curse. Should I be angry with my past, my faith, my parents, or should I be thankful? When I had finished, I closed my journal and went for a walk. I felt fully loved by the people I'd listed. I felt that I had seen them by writing their names, that I'd called them forth. But then, a rush of feeling alone. I knew no one in the nation of Chile, and yet names and faces swirled around me like fireflies. I held my life so graced with kindness and friendship, in my mind's eye as I walked around the tiny town on the edge of a lake in Patagonia. A stray dog came up and trotted next to me, as if drawn by my thinking, as if responding to some deep calling in every dog to comfort a lost boy. Little houses along the Carretera Austral post signs to attract cyclists. Hotels offer musty lounges, old sofas, and instant coffee. But mostly, I camped. I met only one other cyclist in 2 weeks on the road. He was a handsome, tan Italian with expensive gear and a shiny new bike. We got a beer together at the only restaurant for miles. I drank my beer, and he looked at me longer than usual. I didn't give him any cues, but when we parted, I felt handsome for a moment. I was in the zone, each day biking farther than the last, and becoming ever more accustomed to my solitude. An entire day passed without me speaking to a single human. I did speak, though, just to the world. I love talking to the road and to trees and birds. My voice keeps me company. Cycling alone had me back in my head. Here I was, near the end of the journey, and wondering what I'd learned. Had I found freedom? Did I know what I thought about God? No, I just had more fucking questions. Did I feel more awake and young and alive? Yes, I guess I did. But had I experienced page-turning revelations? Some flag to plant in a new continent of understanding? No. One day, exhausted from a frustrating uphill stretch where my tires kept spinning out, I decided to take a nap in the midday sun. I pulled off the road and found a grassy meadow next to a creek. I lay down and closed my eyes. I was roused by buzzing. Not the thin whine of mosquitoes, but the sound of something heavier, bigger. When I opened my eyes, I saw bees, dozens of bees hovering and circling around me. Then I noticed that I had lain down next to a hole in the ground. The bees were pouring out of it. They were crawling on me and crawling all over my bike. The bees were much larger than I was used to, more like bumblebees, and solid orange, like flaming hot Cheetos. But weren't bees from South America supposed to be super poisonous? Or was that Africa? I got up in a hurry and, using a twig with some leaves, gingerly brushed the curious Cheetos off my shirt and bike. Then I got back on the road. Strangely, I hadn't seen a bee in months. I'd actually forgotten about the bees from the beginning of my trip, how they seemed to give me encouragement, signaling to me that I was on the right track. They'd left me for so long. But here they were near the end of my trip, different, bigger, friendlier, impossible to overlook. That night, I stayed in an old lady's house. It was full to the ceiling with knickknacks and every manner of thing. She was a little gnome of a woman and a hoarder. I loved her right away. She rented an upstairs room and promised breakfast for cheap. I told her about the strange bees, resorting to drawing one on a post-it note and saying, "Naranja," and how I was scared they would attack me. She laughed. "Oh no, bees here do not sting you. You are safe." New bees, bigger bees, that don't sting. I liked that, whatever it meant. 3 days later, I took a hard fall. At the edge of a forest, my bike skidded on the gravel. I lost control and fell into the ditch amid a gnarl of logs and stones. For a minute, I lay on the ground, tangled in my bike and bags, wondering what kind of damage I'd discover when I stood up. A gash, a twisted ankle, a broken bone. I moaned and rolled over and pushed myself up. But underneath the scratches and dirt, I was okay. Banged up, but fine. And my bike was fine. As I got back on my bike and tied my things back on, Machu Picchu and Weston and Jesus came to mind. All those dangerous conversations, those bike crashes in my head. I had been told that to walk away from Jesus was to walk away from eternal life, from truth, from community and everything. I would be leaving a weeping mother and a broken life. I would be labeled deceived and lost and a backslider. But as the scenario had been playing out on the trip south, it wasn't so black and white as that. Along the way, I'd asked hard questions, entertained wrong answers, held new ideas with an open hand, and waited to be scalded by fire. Waited for the twisted ankle or broken bone. But it hadn't happened. But then, I wasn't rejecting Jesus, was I? I wasn't walking away. I was just wondering if God was bigger than what I had been told in church. If perhaps he wasn't so jealous, so frightened by the rest of his creation. Backsliding felt a lot like walking forward. Like expanding into love and wonder. I had dared to crash with my old beliefs into the ditch, and I stood up fine. A week later, on a Tuesday, I reached Villa O'Higgins, the terminus of the Carretera Austral. The hamlet, named for the hero of Chilean independence, is laid out on a grid in a valley near the lake of the same name. I would need to take a ferry across this lake back to Argentina. The houses were constructed of tin siding with tin roofs, and some were falling apart. Grass grew tall in most yards. People sat on their stoops, staring without hurry at the world. Actually, nothing hurried here, and I was in a bit of a time crunch to get to Punta Arenas and meet my mom. It wasn't dire, but it wasn't like I could sit around either. Just finding the crossing proved a challenge. The woman at my hostel, where I was the only guest, told me that the ferry was operated by a man in the house with the tractors. Which house is that? You'll see it. Do I just go and knock? Yes. So I set out on foot to wander the town in search of a house with tractors. On the far corner of the grid, I found it, a lean-to of rusted tin with three or four tractors in various states of disrepair parked around the yard. When I knocked on the open door and peered inside, a small, elderly woman appeared. She said something in Spanish that I couldn't understand. She didn't seem to have any teeth. I said, "I have a question about the ferry." "Yes, come," she said, and waved me inside. I walked through a dark room cluttered from floor to ceiling with tractor and boat parts. She led me into the other room of the house. It was so full of oily, dark metal parts that only a hole in the middle of the room had been carved out. In that hole was one recliner, holding an old man who was watching a television a few feet from his face. He glanced up at me, then back to the television. "Yes? Hello?" He was smoking a cigarette. The entire house smelled like smoke, and the ashtray next to him had at least 3 packs worth of butts piled high. The ceiling, what I could see of it above his chair, had turned black. "Ferry? When is the ferry?" I said, terrified and suddenly forgetting any Spanish I knew. "No ferry today," he said, looking at the television. "Oh, yes. Ferry tomorrow?" "No, no ferry." Oh, God, no ferry. Did he mean ever or not tomorrow? He wasn't giving me anything. I was mad at myself for not understanding Spanish better, not taking lessons, not trying harder, letting everyone speak English to me. I couldn't ask the way I needed to. I was so fucked. "Ferry is possible?" I asked. "Ferry on Friday, 9 in the morning. Oh, thank God. "Okay, come here?" I asked. "No, take bus to the dock, bus from the library." "Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you," I said. He smiled, but he was smiling at the TV. As I let myself out, I said thank you to the old woman. I spent 3 days in Villa O'Higgins. I read my book. I met a few other backpackers and even a bike touring couple from England. We drank beer. I ate cookies. I hiked to the top of a nearby hill. It was altogether very nice. On Friday, I caught the ferry. We crossed a huge turquoise lake for 2 hours before we were dropped on the other side. The port here consisted of a cabin painted white with a green roof and a gravel road leading away from it up the hill and into a canyon between 2 mountains. That was my route. 12 miles through the woods, then I'd cross into Argentina again. I tried to ride, but the road was really just a path of baseball-sized rocks. I couldn't ride at all, so I walked my bike. It was already early afternoon, and I walked my bike for several miles and then camped in a field with horses. As I fell asleep, I realized that tomorrow would be my final day on the bicycle. I would reach El Chalten and then be done. I would see Fitzroy, stay the night, and take a bus down to the airport in Punta Arenas, Chile, to meet my mother and friends. Then we'd come back north together to explore the scenic wonders of Torres del Paine. I was almost done. All night, I froze, and only my grin poked out of my sleeping bag. The next day, I walked my bike through dense forest, carrying it over log bridges crossing creek after creek. Before long, my muscles ached. I struggled to stabilize the heavy bike on the skinny path and actually dropped it all in one of the creeks. But I was so high on finishing that I hardly cared. I sang to myself, mostly, "Look at this stuff, isn't it neat?" from The Little Mermaid. Finally, I saw a sign, "Welcome to Argentina." In the distance behind the sign were the peaks of Fitzroy. I took a photo of my bike in front of it all. My day ended with another ferry ride across a small lake. Then, after 3 miles on a nice gravel road, I was in El Chalten. In town, I parked my bike outside a hostel, where I found myself surrounded by tourists and backpackers, some of whom had also cycled the Carretera Austral. After setting my stuff on a bunk bed in a crowded room, I walked back out to the main street. It was sunset. 11,700-foot Fitzroy showed itself through shifting clouds. I had cycled to Patagonia. I drank a beer, feeling proud but calm. I was simply done. Like the last grain of sand dropping in an hourglass, my experiment in time ended without a sound. I never got on the bike again. Chapter 21. Mom and the Mountain, Torres del Paine. 592 miles to go. The next day, I hiked alone to the base of Cerro Torre, which is next to Mount Fitzroy and almost as famous. The peaks here present an incredible skyline of skinny granite spires shaped by the brutal and endless winds and rain, like knives stuck blade up in the snow. I asked a tourist to take my photo. I stood in the hateful wind and let my face get chapped. I hiked back to town and had dinner with some hikers I'd met from England. Then I wandered the main street and thought how alone I was in my accomplishment. All these people were on vacation, doing their own thing. They saw me and assumed I'd flown here, or didn't think about me at all. I was just an extra in the movie of their life. But I knew what I'd done, and so did God. That evening, I stowed the bike in the baggage compartment under a big bus and boarded it for Punta Arenas, Chile, another 1,000 miles south, where I'd meet my mother and two of my friends. On that bus, I had a lot of miles to stare out the window and think about my journey, about expectations, about destinations. I had wanted my spirit quest to answer questions for me. More than that, I needed it to reveal my questions to me, then answer them. What a burden to put on travel, which in itself is ignorant and indifferent. It becomes so hard to just enjoy the thing as it happens. We make the journey about arrival, not travel. We are so goal-focused. We are the dog that won't stop paddling as long as he sees the shore. But man, my shore had been hidden by the fog for so long. Of course, goals help us get a lot done. But they often remove our attention from the experience to the achievement. When we arrive at the goal, we think, then we will be happy. When we finally get there, we can celebrate and have fun. When I get that job, I'll be fulfilled then. When I get married, I will be happy. The Eden we pine for is not under our own feet or bike tires, but over the next mountain. I had crossed the mountain. I was in the Eden of my dreams. I had a couple weeks left in the adventure of a lifetime, but I was here. I had arrived. Now what? I suppose I'd worked through some things on the road. My faith had gotten rearranged, the puzzle pieces disassembled and spread across the table. Not put back together, but not a total mess either. I guess I did feel a warm direction, a positive pulling towards something else. I had always worried that if I took my inherited beliefs off the throne, if I took the Bible out of God's hands and put it in mine, that my life would spin into relativistic nonsense. That's what I'd always been told. Yet I didn't see that happening. I had asked and been asked heretical questions. I had looked straight at the sun and demanded answers, and I was still standing, and I was not blind. Thousands of miles from Peru, from saying goodbye to Weston, he was with me in my heart. His critical mind, fearless to excavate all possibilities, had been hard for my fragile ego. He wasn't afraid to let things change. He'd done that his whole life. He'd fought for heaven, then discarded it like a rumor. He'd tried all the fruits of pleasure and remained unsatisfied. He'd sought the world for truth and freedom, and perhaps he was closer than I was. But his liberty had done something to me. I missed him terribly. I wished he'd been with me. I wished he had been there for Fitzroy, blowing smoke in my face and hugging me. Thanks to him, I had come to realize that there were doors and rooms in the house of my mind that had always been there, but had been boarded up. He'd kicked some of those doors open. I had peeked through broken rules, walked down dark hallways, and the house, even in its mystery and darkness, was still my home, and surprisingly still felt like it. On the carretera, some of my spiritual discomfort had settled. In my aloneness, I had forgiven people. Now they couldn't hurt me. Only nature was real. Christianity couldn't tell me what to do. My mother couldn't tell me what to do. My need to belong and fit in had fallen away into meaninglessness. Mile by mile, only discovery mattered. Yet now, at the end of the trip, I felt a dull melancholy, the way Dayquil can mask a cold but leave you with a muffled head. I was excited, sure, but I was tired. I wondered if old age felt like this, if the end is not a triumph and fireworks, but a simple, quiet arrival, a beer in a pub, and wondering what it was you had wanted so desperately. Looking back at a complex grab bag of lessons, but seeing no through line. Feeling pride of accomplishment, as I did now, but struck by your own cheating and laziness. And finally, you take a cosmic bus to see your mother. Punta Arenas, a port on the Strait of Magellan, lies halfway between the Atlantic and the Pacific. It is the bottom of the world. The shore faces Antarctica. It is the southernmost significant habitation on the continent of South America, with only the islands of Tierra del Fuego and the stormy Drake Passage separating the mainland from the Antarctic. This was as far south as I would get. I arrived and slept in a dingy hostel, my last night alone. I should say I hardly slept. I was so excited to see my mom and my friends. I woke up, had my coffee, and felt both sad to say goodbye to this weird season of my life and thrilled to be done with it. Mom had been texting photos of things she was buying for the trip, hiking boots on sale at TJ Maxx, a men's rain jacket from Goodwill, protein powder that can be mixed with creek water in case of emergency, Ebola protection materials from a website dedicated to preparing for the end times, a Spanish phrasebook, though when she realized it only had slang and curse words, she sent me a picture of the book in the trash. The airport of Punta Arenas had no Wi-Fi, and I knew my mom's phone wouldn't work. It felt like trips to the airport in the early 90s, when no one had cell phones and you had to hope that the time they said they would arrive turned out to be the right time. But standing in the terminal waiting for my mom, I felt proud and strong. I felt like a man. I still couldn't throw a football, but lots of dudes can throw a football, and none of them have lived on a bicycle for 16 months. I wasn't looking forward to my mother's direct questions, her probing, even though I felt okay in my sexuality and my ambiguous faith in a way that I had never been. I just didn't want my mother to be sad with who I'd become. I didn't want her to be mourning her son's dead soul as we explored the mountains together. Then I spotted her curly brown hair and unnecessarily bejeweled sunglasses rounding the corner. She was already yelling for me, laughing with her words. "Jed, I did it. I'm a world traveler. Ecuador and now Patagonia. And at my age." Her brightness and presence made me instantly happy. She pushed past the other passengers and dropped her purse and roller bag for a long hug. When we pulled away, she said, "You look so skinny. Handsome, but skinny. Mama's here. I'm not about to cook, but we're going to eat our way through this Patagonia." She had booked a hotel in an old building that looked like an English castle. We would be staying a night before renting a car for the week and heading north up to Puerto Natales, the closest town to Torres del Paine National Park. Later that evening, my friends Mila and Willow flew in. They had decided to join me for the final exploration of Torres del Paine. I was very happy about that. and honored. Plus, it was easier to be around my mother, with the buffer of a third and fourth party. My mother showed us all the ridiculous things she had packed. She had a folded, tightly packed yellow hazmat suit. She said, "You know, with all the Ebola going around the world on planes, I didn't want to take any chances." She knew she was funny, but she was also serious. From under her t-shirts, she pulled out a gallon bag of almonds. Willow and Mila laughed at every new revelation. "Mom, why so many almonds?" I said. "Did you know you can live off of just almonds for months? Maybe forever. They're just a backup plan." She had non-perishable food in sandwich bags tucked in every corner of her bag. She pulled out a big plastic bag of pills. "What are those?" I asked, incredulous. "Water purification tablets, just in case." "In case of what, Mom?" "I didn't know how the water would be down here, or if we'd be lost in the wilderness and need to survive." I laughed. "Mom, we're staying at an Airbnb." "You never know." The next morning, we picked up the rental car and began the 3-hour drive north to Puerto Natales. The trees ended at the outskirts of town, the terrain becoming rolling hills of grass with clumps of trees around the few farmhouses. In the distance, we could see snow-covered mountains. We saw rheas running along the fences by the side of the road. Rheas look almost exactly like ostriches. We were simply driving across prairie land when a huge bird began racing next to us on the other side of a fence. No one had told me that South America had its own version of native flightless birds. "Look at that ostrich!" my mom screamed. My eyes took a minute to register what we were seeing. It was smaller than an ostrich, but tall as a man, and keeping pace with our car for no apparent reason. I didn't have cell service or Wi-Fi, so we just had to speculate how there could be ostriches down here. It wasn't until that night that I remembered to Google it and learned of the existence of these indigenous giants. We arrived at the cottage my mom had rented just outside Puerto Natales by mid-afternoon. It was attached to a boutique hotel sitting on a broad grassy field that rolled down to the bay, which is connected by a series of channels to the Pacific. The distant mountains were white with snow, but in town, the grass was neon green and lush. Horses waded through it. Puerto Natales swarmed with serious hikers from all over. Europeans, Australians, Israelis, and Americans. They come here to do the circuit hikes around the peaks of Torres del Paine and Cuernos del Paine. The full circuit takes about a week. You camp along the way, stop at ranger cabins to replenish or have a beer, and meet hikers from all over the planet. For 2 days, we played tourists along with the crowds, shopping, horseback riding, and eating well. Then we drove the final 2 hours to the park itself. The landscape in this part of Patagonia is unbelievably expansive. With very few trees, the bare skin of Patagonia shows through. The naked beauty of a raw planet. In the fields stretching away on either side, we saw cows and reyes and vicuñas, which are in the llama family, though with shorter hair, golden brown with white bellies. Clouds would pile up thick and tall over the mountains one moment, then swirl into mist the next, strands of sunlight streaming through over the course of the day in a cycle from hopeful to ominous and back. In the distance, we could see the granite towers of the Torres del Paine Massif approaching. The spires sit on top of a wide-set mountain like a crown. I knew from obsessing over the map that Cuernos del Paine, one of the world's most daunting ascents, was situated on the opposite side of Torres del Paine from us. Instead of a lineup of peaks, Cuernos del Paine looks like a jumbled collection of shard-like spikes rising in a triangle, almost like God had taken a machete to a mountain in a drunken rage. Hiking trails completely encircle both of these wonders. We stopped at a lodge at the foot of Torres del Paine for lunch. While eating, Mom asked, "How many miles is that Torres del Paine hike?" I told her it was about 6 miles, all uphill, then 6 miles back. She swirled her wine glass. "We should do it," she said. "Mom, it's a strenuous hike. I don't think, I want to do it. I'm in good shape. I'll go at my own pace. Are you sure? What if you get hurt? I'll go at my own pace and I won't get hurt. I can't come this far and not try. I feel great. I walk a lot. I don't know, Mom. Okay, don't start this. I've always known that one day my kids would start to baby me as I got older. I know it's coming, but not yet. I'm an adult, and I have my wits about me, and I'm healthy, and I want to do it. Whoa, Mama, okay, sorry to trigger all that, I said, laughing. Okay, let's do it tomorrow, on your 32nd birthday. You know they say Jesus walked on water when he was 32. He lived to be 33. You're in your years of ministry. I know, Mom. We drove back to our cottage in the long twilight of the Patagonian summer. In the morning, I woke to her calling me from the kitchen. Jed, she crooned. Happy birthday, my favorite oldest son. She came into my room and hugged me in my covers. It's time to go climb a mountain. I've packed us sandwiches and little individual bags of almonds and dried fruit I found at the market the other day. All this fresh organic South American fruit. Mom, that fruit is probably from a factory just like at home. Well, I don't know, it seems fresher. I have us big water bottles, metal ones, lightweight, so we don't get that BPA poison in our systems. Oh, and here, she handed me a crystal. I got these at a gift shop. They are crystals from the top of the Andes, and the lady said they are charged with good energy. I think we should have them in our pockets for good luck. I laughed. Mom, when I was a kid, you forbade me from having those little troll dolls with the poofy pink hair because you thought it was witchcraft and unchristian. And here you are giving me a crystal? God made crystals. The Chinese made those troll dolls. Trolls are demonic. Crystals are okay. And so are pennies. Oh my gosh. You always pick up pennies from the ground and say, ooh, good luck. I'm just realizing how superstitious you are, you hypocrite. We were both laughing. Stop micromanaging me, she said. I see those coins as little blessings from God. You're supposed to give them away so both of you will be doubly blessed. Don't be a hater. Mom, never say hater again. We had some coffee and pastries in the lobby of the boutique hotel, and in a moment, while Mom was sitting across the lobby looking at her phone, I asked the owner, who was also the concierge, about the hike. Is the Torres del Paine hike difficult? It is long, very long, but you don't need any mountaineering equipment or anything, he said. Well, I asked more quietly, do you think my mother could do it? He said the only person he'd seen who had done the hike at her age had been a climbing instructor from Switzerland. Is she healthy? It isn't impossible, it is just long. She is very healthy, I said, considering her across the lobby. She was now eating granola and texting. She was 67 years old, but her dyed brown hair, straight posture, and fast talk had made her seem ageless to me. Was she capable of climbing this mountain? Was it a mistake to let her try? Willow and Mila joined us, and we put on our hiking boots. I carried the backpack full of snacks, water, and sandwiches. My mom hung her point-and-shoot camera around her neck with a bright, multicolored neck strap, and the four of us headed back to the park. On the drive, a memory came back to me. I must have been 11 or 12. My parents were already divorced, and I was sitting in the back seat of my dad's truck. We were driving to Sonic to get me a Dr. Pepper as a reward for helping my dad feed hay to the cows. Maybe my dad said something to trigger it, I don't know, but for the first time, it dawned on me that my mom would one day die. The thought bulldozed my mind and knocked everything over. I can remember exactly the bend in the road where I thought it. Mom would die. I would be without her. It felt like a terrible injustice. I remember turning my face to the window so as not to be noticed, pretending my sniffles were allergies. It was 12:30 by the time we parked at the base of the trail. Lots of cars were parked there when we arrived. The hike seemed like the most popular thing to do in the park. That gave me confidence in bringing Mom. There had to be other moms and dads on this hike. As we gathered our stuff and put on our rain jackets, I said, "It definitely looks like it's going to rain. You sure about this, Mom? Honey, I walked across America. I slid down a glacier and got hit by a car going 60 miles an hour. I can handle a little rain. The trail started flat along the base of the Great Mountains, through low grass and over bits of broken rock. We walked for perhaps a mile, crossing streams of meltwater from the snow high above. Mom just crept along, but we all hiked together at first. The trail quickly gained elevation, curled into a canyon at the base of two mountains and headed up the side of one of them, hugging the canyon. Soon we moved along a steep ridge with a long black rock slide down to the right, to white water below. At that point, Mom told us not to wait for her. "Just go at your own pace," she said. "It's not a race, and I'd rather be careful than injure myself and ruin our day." "Mom, we don't want to leave you. It's fine," I said. "No, I insist. I won't have fun or enjoy any of this nature if I feel like you're waiting on me. Go on. I'll enjoy God's creation at my own pace." With that, the girls and I went on ahead. Still, for a while, I dallied, checking on Mom from 100 yards up the trail. She would walk a little, stop, take out a snack, walk some more, stop, look at a flower, take 20 pictures of it, 20 identical photos. She didn't seem to think about the hours of sunlight we had left or how much progress she was making. Finally, I turned around and pressed on to catch up with the girls. We had decided to regroup at the halfway point, where a refugio served food and hot chocolate. For the next 2 hours, we hiked mostly straight up. The trail wound along bluffs and then entered an old-growth forest. Under the towering trees, everything gleamed wet and fresh. Ferns grew from black soil, and fallen logs sprouted mushrooms and lichen. A rain shower came and went, but the canopy of the forest kept us dry. Willow, Mila, and I made it to the refugio, a dark green cabin on the river with a large deck and lots of picnic tables. At this point, it was late afternoon. Hikers there were stopping on their way back down. A young Australian working behind the counter told me we were halfway and that we should hurry. "You don't want to be hiking after dark." After 45 minutes, Mom strolled up brandishing a new walking stick and pulling little rocks from her fanny pack to show around. Each had a story. I told her we shouldn't rest long. From there, we crossed a log bridge over rushing snowmelt. The ground was black and moist. Moss and green ferns grew everywhere. It had begun to drizzle or mist, or that strange in-between place where water seems to float in the air and collect on your face and sleeves. Mom was getting tired, but she kept up a pleasant conversation anyway. She pointed out delicate ferns and flowers. One little collection of flowers looked like chubby maids in white and yellow bonnets, and my mom squealed in delight and knelt down to take a photo. 20 photos. I told her we needed to keep moving. "If I can't enjoy the trail, what's the point in the hike?" she said. I started walking on ahead again, letting my thoughts drift back over my trip, thinking how far I'd come, wondering whether or not I had changed at all. I had. I knew I had. But how? These walkabouts, these rites of passage, these spirit quests are meant to transform. We want to meet Jesus on the road, to be stopped in our tracks by a white light or a burning bush. I didn't get any of that. I got the erosion of the shoreline of a river, one pebble at a time. I wanted to change. I wanted to be born different, to be replaced and born again, new, forgotten and remade. I don't know how that happens. I guess you have to completely erase your past, which I wasn't ready to do, so I carried it with me, no matter how hard I ran from it. Clunking up the trail in my boots, I was making great headway. By now, the girls were somewhere up ahead, out of my view, and my mom was somewhere behind. These stunning monoliths of Torres del Paine would mark the true end of my journey. The trip felt like forever, but also here I was, in the present, with the moment rushing past me as though I were a stone in a creek. Time didn't quite move like I'd thought. I had wanted to slow it down. I wanted to be aware of every moment passing in reflection and contemplation. I wanted to leave my office life in order to feel time passing in some more holy way, holding it in my fingers and studying each minute like a prayer bead. But that isn't how we experience life. The first miles in Oregon, I had been self-conscious in the extreme. I had felt my knees and hands and breath. On our bikes, Weston and I rushed through the pungency of seafoam and evergreen, crazy with euphoria, sure the newness of it all would be eternal. But then we slid into living the trip, and my awareness dulled into routine. I had been reborn into a different life, a different normal. The bicycle, the camping, the two-lane highways, the people and cultures had become patterns I could predict. I had wanted slowness, but I got life. An older couple, perhaps in their 50s, came from around a bend ahead of me. They were headed down the mountain. I asked how close I was to the top, and they said, perhaps another hour, with German accents. It was now 6 p.m., and it got dark at 10:30. I kept myself calm by thinking that the walk back down would take half the time. I waited for a few minutes for my mom to catch up, then decided to keep going. She was going at her pace, and she asked for that, and I would go at mine. The trail got steeper. How was my mom doing now? I got it in my head that she had fallen, that those Germans would find her and think me a terrible son. But I kept hiking. This is your trip, your finish, I told myself. You go, and she can catch up. If you don't see those towers, those Torres del Paine, you'll never forgive yourself, or her. She asked for this hike. She doesn't want the end of your adventure to be babysitting. I immediately felt guilty for the thought, that she had taken care of me and raised me, and I was inconvenienced by her slow pace. When the forest ended, the trail came to a giant pile of boulders, an uphill cascade of gray stones, each one larger than a car. The trail snaked around and through them, but it was easy to lose. Any young climber would have simply crawled and scampered up and over the giant rocks. I was almost to the top, but the end was the hardest. I sat down on a rock and waited again. I didn't want to see the end without Mom. I waited there for 30 minutes. She must have stopped. She wasn't coming. Maybe she was too tired. Maybe she went back to the refugio for hot chocolate. Maybe all this waiting for her, which she told me not to do, was actually slowing us down. The sky was dimmer and grayer, and I was so near the end of the trail, the end of my trip. The girls must already be at the lake, at the granite spires of Torres del Paine. I decided I had to go on. I couldn't wait for my mom, because she wasn't coming. I climbed full speed up the boulders, crawling over them like a lizard, and entered layers of mist that came and went. It would mask the trail ahead of me in total gray whiteness, and then be gone, like a paintbrush dragging the ground. As I climbed, for a moment, the higher fog parted, and there were the towers, each one the size of the Titanic turned on its stern, maybe bigger, truly giant spears striking at the sky. No wonder this was a destination. It was holy in its grandeur. I kept climbing to reach the end of the trail, which, based on photos, was a lake at the base of the three spires. The air was cold, but by now I had slipped into my animal brain. I was looking from rock to rock, boulder to trail to handhold, focused only on what was before me. My hands are cold. Put them in your sleeves and don't touch the rocks with your bare skin. Climb over this boulder. Put your right foot here. Breathe through your nose. This boulder is wobbly. Step lightly and watch your ankles. It was meditative. I rounded a massive boulder, and suddenly there I was, at the top of the boulder pile, staring at a lake. It looked like the top of a volcano, a hole scooped out of the summit. The scoop was filled with perfect blue-green water. Lining the lake were the three granite towers rising up like God's fat fingers above the lake in the palm of his hand. Photos made it seem so approachable. It was not. It was mighty. The sheer scale of it reminded me of the Old Testament God, a God who struck fear in the hearts of men, a humbling, respectful terror. For me, only mountains and canyons have this effect on me. The ocean